Welcome to our Bible study on 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 4 through 11, and verses 16 through 20. As always, I'm assuming that you have read the passage, that you have your Bible open before you, and that you understand our translations may not agree. I also want to invite you to join us live and in person on Wednesday at 5:15 at the Fellowship Hall at the church and be a part of a live Bible study discussion on this passage. The books of 1 and 2 Samuel tell us of one of the most crucial periods of transition in Israel. At the beginning of 1 Samuel, Israel is a loose federation of tribes, experiencing both external threats from the Philistines and an internal crisis because of the corruption of the priestly house of Eli at Shiloh, where the Ark of the Covenant, remember that movie, was kept and traditions were preserved. By the end of 2 Samuel, a monarchy is firmly in place under David. The changes necessary for this transition provide some of the most dramatic stories in the Old Testament, narrating not only dramatic events, but also striking characters and personalities, some of whom overlap, such as Samuel, Saul, and David. In chapter 8, the elders of Israel come to Samuel and demand a king, despite the fact that in chapter 7, we see that a king is not needed, that the leadership of God's prophet Samuel has been enough. Samuel has been faithful in his judging of Israel, and his prayer was instrumental in the defeat of the Philistines. And by the way, judging as used in this instance and in the book of Judges really means leadership. Certainly, there may have been times in which a judge would settle disputes, but mostly it means leadership. But in the beginning of chapter 8, we are told that Samuel has grown old and Samuel's sons are corrupt, which is ironic because if you remember, Samuel had replaced Eli, not because Eli was corrupt, but because Eli's sons were corrupt. Now the same thing has happened to Samuel. Now it's Samuel's sons who are corrupt. As we look at chapter 8, verses 4 through 11, we see that our passage begins at verse 4 with the elders of Israel approaching Samuel in his hometown of Ramah. Elders, as it is used here, is not like the elders that we have in our churches today. And while it is not clear what segment of Israel these elders represent, it is likely they were the heads of various families. And in verse 10, it refers to them as the people who were asking for a king. Some have speculated that because they do not seem to be worried about the burdens of kingship as outlined in verses 10 through 17, they may be representing the influential and wealthy families in Israel who were most likely to gain from the move to kingship. There is no indication that the complaint of the elders in verse 5 is illegitimate. Samuel is old, and his sons do not follow in his ways. But the most surprising part of their request is that they want to be like other nations, a phrase that will be repeated in verse 20. Such a change in leadership would represent a significant shift for Israel, a shift away from their distinctiveness as a nation, and to conform with the patterns of other nations, putting Israel's unique identity at risk. Remember, Israel is the only nation in the area that is monotheistic, that is, believing in one God, while the other surrounding nations are polytheistic, believing in many gods. It is possible that Samuel may have seen a risk that in their desire to be like other nations, the people will begin to believe in other gods. And indeed, when we read the Old Testament, we see that some of the people and even their leaders do exactly that. At any rate, it seems clear that the elders envisioned this king as a successor to Samuel, and they want Samuel to appoint this king. In verse 6, Samuel is displeased by their request, and when he prays to God, we almost get the sense that he takes their request as a personal affront, and that he is tattling on the people to God. In verse 7, God's response is surprising. God commands Samuel to listen to the voice of the people, for they have not rejected you, but have rejected me from being king over them. God goes on in verse 8 to point out how from the day God brought them out of Egypt to this day, the people have forsaken God and served other gods, and now are doing the same thing to Samuel. In other words, the elders' request is not a rejection of Samuel, but a rejection of God. In verse 9, God for the second time, remember the first time was in verse 7, instructs Samuel to listen to their, meaning the people's, voice. The tone is indulgent and tolerant. God does not approve, but God permits. But Samuel is also told to solemnly warn them. In effect, God tells Samuel to let the people know what they are in for. Samuel is to warn them, but he is also to do what they asked. In verses 10 through 11, we hear the beginning of Samuel's speech, which actually continues to verse 18. Samuel's speech is a catalog of the royal abuse of power. The practices reflected in verses 11 through 17 fit well with the foreign practices forbidden to Israel's kings in the laws of the king in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 14 through 20. And by the way, for those of you who just now looked up the reference in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 14 through 20, remember that was written at a time in Israel's history when they did not have an earthly king. It is almost like Deuteronomy is foreshadowing the events that will eventually unfold. Regardless of the origins of this portrait on kingship, it is clear that Samuel is using it as an attempt to dissuade the people from their request for a king. Although verse 10 says that Samuel reported the words of the Lord, there is no suggestion in verse 10 that Samuel is going to tell the people that the Lord is going to grant their request. In fact, even after God instructs Samuel a third time in verse 22 to listen to the voice of the people, Samuel still does not tell the people that God has acquiesced to their request. It appears in verses 10 through 18 that Samuel is not even attempting to share any advantages a kingship may bring. He is not interested in presenting a balanced picture, but is intentionally putting a negative spin on the people's request and is dragging his feet. In verse 11, Samuel is clearly trying to convince the people to withdraw their request. He highlights how the young men will be conscripted for military service. And if we go beyond our passage, in verses 12 through 13, they will also be farming royal holdings, manufacturing implements, and their daughters will be working as perfumers, cooks, and bakers. In verse 14, the king will take away the best of the productive land and redistribute it to his officers and servants. As our passage picks up again at verses 16 and 17, Samuel says the king will require a tenth of all forms of wealth, including servants, grains, vineyards, flocks, cattle, donkeys, and the people will end up as the king's slaves. Samuel's speech portrays royal privilege as grasping and debilitating. What is the justice of a king? A king will take, 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 and take some more. To serve a king is to return to bondage, to reverse what God had done in the Exodus, referred to actually earlier in verse 8 of our passage. The fate that Samuel describes would undercut the very identity of Israel as God's delivered people. At verse 18, Samuel concludes by saying the day will come when the people will cry out because of their king, but the Lord will not answer. The cry and answer that brought deliverance under Samuel in chapter 7, verse 9, is reversed. The pattern of outcry and divine answer, which has been Israel's hope and security from the Exodus onward, is now, at least in Samuel's opinion, broken. This sequence has been particularly marked in the book of Judges, but Samuel says that under a king, the time of divine answer is ended. Also in verse 18, Samuel says, "The king you have chosen for yourselves." But in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 15, it says the king is to be one whom the Lord your God will choose. And as we see in 1 Samuel chapter 9, Saul is chosen by God, not by the people. And then, of course, later, God chooses David. In verse 19, the people refuse to listen to Samuel. Samuel's warning has no effect. The people's response is a resounding no. In some ways, this is not overly surprising, because Samuel has not offered any real alternative. Samuel is still old, and his sons are still corrupt. In verse 20, the reasons for having a king are expanded. The people not only want to be like other nations and have a king govern them, but they also want the king to go out before them and fight their battles. Now, this is the first hint of a military justification for king, and it is possible that the Philistine threat is behind their remark. As we look at 1 Samuel chapter 8, it is possible to see the people have a legitimate complaint, and Samuel is not offering any real remedy. The system is breaking down. Samuel may be defensive and dragging his feet, but the elders seem to want more than an answer to a possible legitimate problem. They want to be like everyone else. In conclusion, the people will get their desire for a king, but as mentioned earlier, it is God who will choose. Saul will fail, but the failures of Saul will allow for the possibilities of David. This concludes our study. Thank you for joining us. Next week's study will be on 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 6 through 10, and verses 14 through 17, but feel free to read those verses in between. Thank you for listening. Take care, and God bless.